listening to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. Let's talk. And I am Hallie Kesser-Jane. Welcome to my listeners in the United States and around the world. Tune in to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show at HallieKesserJane.com. Today on the show, a tour of history's worst plagues with Jennifer Wright, author of Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them, and a conversation with the best-selling maestro of mayhem, Tim Dorsey, out with his 20th Laugh Riot thriller, fueled with his cast of miscreants, Clownfish Blues. That's today on the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. Let's get to it. We begin with Jennifer Wright. Get out your face masks, buy stock in hand sanitizer, and batten down the hatches. Germs are catching and the next plague might be right around the corner. In Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them, Wright takes us on a witty and irreverent tour of history's worst plagues and offers up a celebration of the heroes who fought them. Throughout time, humans have been terrified and fascinated by the diseases history and circumstance have dropped on them. Some of the responses to those outbreaks are almost too strange to believe. The author of It Ended Badly, 13 of the Worst Breakups in History, and contributor to the New York Observer, the New York Post, Cosmopolitan, Glamour, Maxim, and more, Jennifer Wright does the seemingly impossible, informs, makes us laugh, and scares us to death in Get Well Soon. Let's talk. All right, from It Ended Badly, 13 of the Worst Breakups in History, to Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them. That's quite a leap, my friend. How'd you make it? Why'd you make it? It's hilarious.
Well, you know, everybody keeps saying that, and I just write about the things that are keeping me awake at night. So I started working on Get Well Soon during the Ebola outbreak, when it felt like every time I turned on the news, there was another story about how Ebola was going to come to America, and it was going to kill us all. And like I imagine a great many other people, that made me pretty nervous. So I started reading up on how people had dealt with plagues in the past, and what are behaviors that help us society survive or even thrive during a plague, and what are behaviors that can really make life more difficult for the afflicted or even lead to the complete collapse of a society. So the book is really an attempt to examine those questions.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because, you know, I'm thinking about, I am like a freak around disaster films.
Right? Oh, me too.
You like them too?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm just like,
oh,
and,
yeah,
right?
I can't stop watching.
I don't know what that's about. And I think that that's important to this conversation in a funny way, because what is it about us as human beings that we really are, you know, just drawn to these macabre, horrible parts of humanity's world, you know? And I'm
absolutely.
And I'm sure you were thinking about that when you were writing the book and you got into all of it. But are you a hypochondriac?
honestly, a little, probably less now. By researching it, I usually manage to alleviate some of my fears. So I find it very comforting to know that we have penicillin now. Nobody dies of syphilis now unless they really let it go. Only about 10 people a year in the U.S. get the bubonic plague, which still kind of surprised me that anybody is getting the bubonic plague.
Yeah, that's pretty wild,
but
right?
We have medicine to treat it, and we can handle it now.
All
so,
right. So let's get into some of this.
Book,
oh, wait, go,
oh,
ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I interrupted you.
The book that really terrified me was the Spanish flu in 1918, which killed 50 million people worldwide. It killed 675,000 Americans, which are more than have died in combat in all the wars we fought. And nobody really knows why it went away. Nobody came up with a cure for it. Some scientists theorize that it just killed so many hosts that it disappeared. So that's the one that kind of keeps me awake at night now.
Well, thanks for sharing that, my friend.
Great. Yeah. Right. Happy to share.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting because as we go along in this conversation, we'll see, you know, the great strides that have been made to fight some of this stuff and what have you. But when you think about this, that you think, oh my gosh, you know, sometimes there just really aren't answers. And that keeps me awake at night. What's the difference between a plague and an epidemic?
Oh, well,
is there one?
You know, for the purposes of my book, I didn't really differentiate between them. A plague has a little more global scale. So a plague is probably something that affects everyone. An epidemic might be something that is more confined to one place. Although at this point, I think we are also globally interconnected that nothing will ever be confined to one place. If you hear about an airborne disease in Africa, you should start worrying because somebody will come here from there, and they'll do it very quickly because we have planes and trains and automobiles and everything else to take you everywhere in the world.
That brings me to two thoughts. One is the word pandemic, which is probably the newer word that we use today because of the global nature of it. But I live in Florida, so let me explain to you. That's another country. It's not the United States. We are inundated, you know. Boy, that summer season comes and those mosquitoes come and there's just, you know, there's always something down here. It's like,
and, oh yeah, there are worries about the Zika virus.
Oh my God, please. It's like, so, and the, I can't even say it, the chatuka or something like that. Every disease that is out there lands here. It's
so
a beautiful
sorry.
Place to visit, but it's a nice place to leave too. and what have you. And I guess Africa kind of feels the same way. That's the other place that I spend a lot of time. But let's talk about the early days of the original ones that you get into in the book. And is it that the gods aren't as mad at humankind as they used to be? Because we don't seem to have the plagues that we had when we go back into history. And we're going to start with you on one of the, you know, the first. But just answer that question, because I think that's interesting.
Well, we could say that the gods gave us penicillin.
Okay.
And they also gave us vaccines. And boy, vaccines are the best thing that has ever happened to humanity. Depends on whether or not to vaccinate your children. Do it. They're great. The Aztecs or Incas would love to tell you about how great they are. But they can't because their entire civilizations were wiped out by smallpox within a year.
A good point you make, my political friend. Very good point that you make. It's so ridiculous, all of this crazy talk. I mean, let's just kill each other by thinking crazy thoughts. Okay, so...
No, it was very scary for me to realize that we now have a lower vaccination rate for measles than countries like Rwanda in Africa. And...
Go figure.
The case, because then there will start being outbreaks. And unfortunately, I think some people have forgotten that children really did die of measles.
I'm here to tell the story that I almost did. I almost died of measles. So I know how horrible measles can be, which is one of the reasons why I say vaccinate. It was horrible. Yeah, because when I was growing up, we didn't have the vaccine. But I don't want to age myself too much. Let's go back to the beginning here. Antonine plague, i.e. the word. Talk to me.
Yes. No, the Antonine plague was probably smallpox. And it happened when Marcus Aurelius was the emperor of Rome. And at its height, it was killing thousands of people a day. And this is really a case about how wonderful it can be to have a strong leader and a leader who remains very, very calm in the face of adversity. Because Marcus Aurelius, who had, you know, he was a famed Stoic. He didn't let his moods be changed too much by outside influence, was really able to just approach all of the disasters that accompany the Antonine Plague in a very pragmatic way. So the first thing he did was see about everything the government could legally do to help people that were being afflicted by this. So he imposed laws about how you couldn't turn your house into a mausoleum to profit off of it. You couldn't dig up graves and put more bodies in them. And the government started subsidizing funerals. Like, they did everything that they could in terms of keeping the bodies off the streets. Because once bodies start piling up in the town square, society has broken down. At that point, people will just start panicking and looting and everything will fall apart. So that was very smart. There are definitely other plagues where people have not been so good about keeping the bodies out of the streets. And then when the army got decimated and Germanic tribes started crossing over the border, Marcus Aurelius conscripted all the gladiators to go and fight in the army. And then when people started complaining about how now they couldn't go to gladiatorial games, because people will complain about being deprived of their entertainment more than they will ever complain about the disease. So same thing happens during the Spanish flu in 1918. People knew that everybody around them was dying, but they were furious when movie theaters got closed down. And so,
what
Marcus
does Aurelius, that say about humanity?
We really just want things to be normal. We just want things to keep going. And so Marcus Aurelius started staging these shows in the arenas where wild animals would fight each other to give the public something to watch. When the army didn't have enough money to pay all of the new recruits, Marcus Aurelius auctioned off his own imperial possessions in the form of Trajan to raise funds. So he was someone who was really able to see one problem, respond to it, see the next problem, respond to it. And some people still say that he did this for about 10 years, and some people still say that if he had lived longer, he most likely died of the Antonin plague himself, maybe the decline of the Roman Empire would have been staved off. But unfortunately, helming an empire that's being devastated by plague is like captaining a ship while simultaneously doing triage to bail water out of the hull of that ship. It's almost impossible to do, and it was definitely impossible for Marcus Aurelius' successor to do, because Commodus was just an idiot. Just spent most of the time trying to rename the calendar after himself.
It's interesting. When you look back and you went through the history of the big plagues, and as you put it in the book, did you see where people actually learned from each event, or they didn't learn?
Well, you know, I was really hopeful going into this book that we would get better at responding to every plague throughout history. I expected to see just a very general upward trajectory up until modern day. On every plague, we would get better and get wiser and get more compassionate. And wow, that is not true at all. It is completely random whether people are going to behave kindly and nobly and sensibly during a plague, or if they're just going to burn a whole bunch of people as witches.
Oh my God. You know, really, there's some interesting things in this book, to say the least. But, you know, one thing you did great, I love it, at the beginning of the chapters, you put these quotes in that would lead into the chapter. I want to just read the Woody Allen one because it just cracked me up. I really relate. I was nauseous, untingly all over. I was either in love or I had smallpox. That's me, I think. Everything, man, I'm sick about the whole thing. Who knows? Who knows? This, you also have these pictures in the book. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? I saw these pictures of people with smallpox. I almost had a heart attack. I mean,
are you kidding? I know, you flipped to the end with all the horrific pictures.
Oh my! Of course, of course. I'm very visual. Besides being very audio, auditory.
I wanted to make sure those were all clustered at the end.
So yeah, it was a good idea. But that was
across them. When they read in lunch.
But some of these have really been just awful diseases, and smallpox certainly is one of those. Talk to me.
Oh, smallpox was so unbelievably horrible. And you look at these Aztec and Incan civilizations that were really some of the most developed nations in the world at the time. Then the Spanish settlers come, they bring smallpox, and those civilizations just don't exist within a year. So complete was the destruction that smallpox brought. And that was partly because the people in America at that time had none of the exposure to smallpox that Spaniards might have had, partly because it's transmitted by cows, which they didn't have in the New World. So the Aztecs and Incas, I think, exclusively used llamas, so they hadn't built up even the mildest resistance to this disease. So, yeah, there's a report from a Spanish missionary at the time talking about how he's terrified because he doesn't believe enough of these people will survive to make it possible to colonize this entire continent, because all of them are dying.
Dying of a really horrendous disease to boot.
Ugly, horrible way to die.
Really. Yeah. I mean, just amazing. I want to skip ahead a little bit. And I'm taking this out of the way you put them all in the book. So just play with me here. No Nose Club.
Oh, I love the No Nose Club. The No Nose Club was founded by Mr. Crumpton. And at the time he founded it, syphilis was unbelievably stigmatized. Upton Sinclair has this wonderful story called The Doctor's Dilemma about the problems of syphilis, where it was sexually transmitted. So it's about this young man who's engaged to be married, but he has a mistress, and he gets syphilis from her. So he goes to his doctor to see what's wrong with him, and the doctor says, yes, you have syphilis. You're going to have to wait at least 2 years until this goes into remission, so it won't affect your fiancé. And honestly, even that was pretty iffy. Like, don't marry someone with syphilis unless, you know, they're going to take penicillin. You can do it now. It's fine. But the man says, no, that would ruin my fiancé's reputation. We have to get married now. So they get married. He gives syphilis to his wife. She never knows that she has it. She passes it on to their baby. Then they hire a wet nurse to feed the baby, and the baby passes it on to her. So Upton Sinclair really examines in the story, at what point is it the doctor's duty to tell someone that syphilis is being spread through this whole family? Spoiler, he never does. But there were a lot of cases like that where it was a disease that was so stigmatized that if people even knew what it was, they would never, ever tell people that they had it. And that seems insane to me, because if it advances far enough, syphilis causes your nose to rot off your face. People would make up, like, very elaborate excuses about how, like, they were in an accident and now, oh, they have no nose. And Mr. Crumpton was someone who had syphilis and was also very wealthy, and just decided to invite a bunch of people who had no noses over to his house for monthly dinners. So they all went. Apparently they had very rambunctious conversations about who would box each other's nose in if they were in a fight. And, you know, it seems like a very bizarre idea, but it's also the groundwork for every support group that we have today. So if you know people who, you know, have Alzheimer's or have cancer and they have a support group that they go to talk about what they're experiencing, we have Mr. Crumpton to thank for that.
Back to syphilis. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. Here's one that I had never heard of called the Dancing Plague. What?
Oh, yes. The Dancing Plague happened in 1518 in the town of Strasbourg, and 400 people began dancing, and they weren't able to stop. And this seems like it could be kind of fun, like it doesn't sound that bad, until you realize that they were dancing until bones poked out of their feet. They were dancing until they had heart attacks in the street. Their families would try to restrain them. They would break free of their bonds and go back to dancing. So this was a really terrible problem. And when I read this, 1518 was also, like, a very popular time for burning witches. So I thought, okay, all these people are going to get burnt as witches. This is going to be a short chapter. And remarkably, that was not what happened. The town threw its very limited resources into attempting all these different ways to cure people. They hired professional musicians to see if maybe the people just needed to dance it out. That wasn't the case. Then they issued decrees about how you really shouldn't play music because you might be depriving your neighbors a chance at recovery. And finally, they sent them off to St. Vitus's shrine. St. Vitus is the patron saint of dancers. And the people supposedly danced around the shrine and they were cured. And now, I don't want to overestimate the curative properties of shrines. It was probably because it was a psychological malady. It seems like a pretty clear case of mass hysteria. But it is miraculous to me that in a time when it would have been very easy to cast out these people, The community was incredibly compassionate. They treated them all as victims of the disease. They didn't see them as possessed by devils. And frankly, that's better than we sometimes do today.
I'm laughing. When I was a kid, my uncle used to tell me that I had St. Vitus dance because I was so hyperactive.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it goes back to that. That's one I hadn't heard before, though. Now, here's another one. I'm going to personalize this one, too. This is one of the fascinating things about me. When I picked up this book and I said I had to have you on the show. Encephalitis, when I was a kid growing up in New Jersey, we had an outbreak. It was one of the...
Oh, no.
Are you aware of stuff happening like that? It was...
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
Right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, yes. Kids were dropping dead, I have to say, in my neighborhood. And my folks happened to have been away for a long time, and I was there, and I was terrified. I remember you couldn't go out after, you know, at dusk because of the mosquitoes, this, that, and the other thing. That's another plague, though. Talk to me.
It is. And Von Eckamo, who worked on Encephalitis Lethargica, talked about how it was a disease that would never, ever be forgotten. And, of course, as soon as we're not being confronted with diseases right in front of us, we just forget all about them. So, yeah, Oliver Sacks really wrote better about Encephalitis Lethargica than I ever will. It was this exceptionally terrifying disease where it would put people in an almost vegetative state where they could respond to stimuli, but they could never act of their own volition. So if you fed them, they could swallow food. If you pulled them up by the hands and made them walk from place to place, they could walk. But they could never do those things just because they wanted to do them. And there are some fascinating cases where people contracted Encephalitis Lethargica in the 1920s, and they were kept alive by their families or put into homes where they were taken care of. And in the 1970s, Oliver Sacks obtained new medicine. It's called L-DOPA. And he injected the people who had Encephalitis Lethargica, and they experienced a kind of awakening where, for a brief time, unfortunately, the effects weren't permanent, they were able to get up and walk around and share stories. And
It's a wonderful book. And film. What was the
movie with Robin Williams?
Yeah, there you go. What was the name of the film?
Oh, Awakening.
Awakenings. I love that movie. But the kids around me were dying. They weren't put into temporary goodbye.
Yeah, no. I mean, encephalitis is a little different than encephalitis lethargica.
Okay. All right. But it was scary as hell. That's all I have to tell you about that.
Oh, yeah.
Out of all the stories that you uncovered, extraordinary research, what's the one that got to you?
The one that upset me the most, and I know it's not technically a plague, it really shouldn't be in there, but it just upset me so much, was the story of lobotomies.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of Walter Freeman Jackson II, who was just this supposedly very charismatic, publicity-hungry charlatan, who really capitalized on the PTSD that people were experiencing in post-war America by inventing the lobotomy and promising some very desperate people that it was going to cure depression. It was going to cure anxiety. It was going to cure headaches. It was going to cure whatever post-war ailments you might have. And, of course, the cons of lobotomies that rendered people essentially toddlers far, far outweighed the cons, far, far outweighed the pros. But that did not stop Walter Freeman Jackson from driving across the country in a lobotomobile, just lobotomizing people as he went. Some of them didn't really want to be lobotomized.
There were a lot of those who were forced lobotomies.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't the Kennedy daughter have a lobotomy?
Rose.
Yeah.
Rosemary, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a tragic story.
Yeah, horrible story.
I know. And she seemed like she was, I mean, she wasn't certainly the brightest member of the Kennedy clan, but she seemed like a very lovely, perfectly functional person beforehand.
But stigma.
Yes, she was just absolutely destroyed by her lobotomy and essentially became a vegetable afterwards.
Right. It was all the stigma.
Oh, yeah. No, the craziest thing to me was I was reading notes from Walter Freeman Jackson about his post-operative patients, And they say things like, Rose is a perfectly happy patient who has the personality of an oyster. She can't remember my name. She pours and pours from an imaginary coffee cup. And then, say, Rose, who was a 29-year-old married woman, would be returned to her family, who would respond with horror, and Walter Freeman Jackson would write them notes that said things like, it seems like she's misbehaving, so she might need an old-fashioned spanking, and then a bowl of ice cream and a kiss and makeup. She's a 29-year-old woman. She was married. That's astonishingly terrifying to me that someone could see those effects and say, I'm just going to keep going with this. Mm. It seems fine to me.
Unbelievable, right? Unbelievable. And you know, it's funny because if you look back and then you look forward and you go, have we really made all that many strides in how we treat people? It's kind of an odd deal. So here we go. Are we due for another plague? Have we been lucky that there haven't been plagues? Or are there plagues? I'm going to name one. You name it, too. We may not call plagues, but they are plagues. We could say AIDS, for instance.
AIDS is a plague.
Okay, and let me just finish with a comma before I throw it over to you. Or we could say Donald Trump. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I strongly feel like if the definition of a good ruler during a plague is someone who remains very, very calm, we better really hope there's no plague in the next 4 years.
Go, kiddo.
But no, I absolutely believe that AIDS is an ongoing plague. And I also believe that I'm a millennial. My generation is the first generation that hasn't had to deal with a plague in our midst in America. My parents' generation had to deal with AIDS. My grandparents' generation had to deal with polio. Before that, they were dealing with the Spanish flu in 1918. It seems, I hope we'll never have to deal with one, but it seems very unlikely that we would be the only generation that doesn't have to deal with a plague that we don't initially know how to combat. And I think one of the things that worries me the most right now is that we're finding things that are resistant to antibiotics, because antibiotics are really the best thing we have when it comes to combating plague. And they're a big reason that the trajectory of how we handle plague seems like it gets better, like a very slow slope for about 2,000 years. And then we invent penicillin and we find out about antibiotics and it just goes straight up. So when I read about superbugs that are resistant to antibiotics, that's very, very frightening.
I agree. We didn't get a chance to talk about some of the heroes, per se. I'm going to throw out a name, Typhoid Mary. A lot of us have heard about Typhoid Mary. I don't think a lot of people really know her story. But I don't want you to tell it because I want people to pick up Get Well Soon, because this is a great, fun, fabulous, informative read.
Oh, thank you so much. That is so nice to hear.
I've been speaking with Jennifer Wright, the author of Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them. For more about the book, visit Amazon.com. You are listening to the Hallie Kasserjain Show. My guests today are Jennifer Wright, author of Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them, and Tim Dorsey, author of Clownfish Blues. Tune in to the Hallie Kasserjain Show at HallieKasserjain.com. The best-selling maestro of mayhem, Tim Dorsey, has been called many things. A nut, a nice guy, the artist of literary insanity. He has written 19 laugh riot thrillers, novels fueled by a cast of miscreants, among them Coconut Cowboy and Florida Roadkill. Now he brings to us his 20th book, the uproarious Clownfish Blues, featuring everyone's favorite gloriously unrepentant Florida serial killer, Serge A. Storms. And according to its starred book list review, if you haven't already, and if not, why, met Serge A. Storms, Florida's most rabid history fan and most cheerful serial killer. Now is the time. Dorsey, a former reporter and editor for the Tampa Tribune, grew up in a small town about an hour north of Miami called Riviera Beach. Currently, he lives on the other coast of Florida, the far west city known as Tampa. Let's talk. All right, so let's start with this, my friend Tim. So tell me about Florida water. you, Carl Hyacin, my good friend Dave Barry, all masters of irreverence and the absurd, so filled with insight, all brilliant. I'm calling you brilliant because I think you are. What's the story? You got any clue? Is it the water?
It's, I don't know. I mean, well, like Carl Hyacin mentions the weather, because it's like, if you're a criminal and you're going to steal, you have the choice of stealing cars in Detroit in the winter or in Miami, you know, where are you going to go? So there's this hat, but, now just the demographics, you know, the rapid rise in population from about the late 50s onward. And then, you know, so a lot of the communities that don't have roots, there's a very transient population. I think all that ends up, it's like, it's a recipe for chaos, and not being facetious.
I couldn't agree. Right. I couldn't agree more. How about the heat?
The heat. Yeah. Well, they say it's not the heat, it's the stupidity. So,
no,
it's hard to explain. And if you tell people, I mean, the main thing, now the country is catching on. I mean, we were kind of known for, you know, back in the 90s and 80s, you know, kind of the Miami Vice-ish. Yeah, so they knew a lot of stuff was going on. But it really got weird, like, after the, you know, millennium, and, you know, you have the Florida Man thing, and people are just looking for those strange headlines coming out of Florida. I mean, we have now this national reputation specifically for people just doing the craziest stuff. I'll tell you one thing. It was like, you know, people ask about the material, and I say, you know, and it's Carl and Dave say the same things. It's like right out of the newspaper, but you don't even need a newspaper anymore, because, my wife told me this story. She got home from work. And the thing is, I've got to remember, I'm almost desensitized now to when something's strange. My wife said, I had to take a detour on the way to work today. The road was closed down ahead. Some naked guy was running across the hoods of cars. And I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, it just didn't. And then, because, I mean, I've heard of that happening in a half dozen cities in Florida so far. You know, it just, people just, I don't know.
It's just crazy. It's crazy land. And you know, it's funny because I, you know, I've been Floridian most of my life. I have to tell you, you know, so I moved to LA for a few years. And in those years, we had Charles Manson. I mean, but all of the crazy of California has rolled east into the peninsula. This is wacky land. And you capture it so beautifully. Let's get to Clownfish Blues. Oh my God. Book number 20. That's impressive. Featuring everybody's favorite gloriously unrepentant Florida serial killer. Only in Florida could a Floridian write about a Floridian serial killer. Oh my God. And Florida's most rabid history fan, Serge A. Storms. Folks, if you haven't read this, you have to really think when you're reading one of his books. So his sidekick, Buddy Coleman, number 20, as I said, and I bet they told you it wouldn't last this long. Are you as surprised as anybody that you're on number 20?
Yeah, you can't. I mean, I don't know. I don't think anyone, if they're just trying to write their first book, sees down the road this far. I mean, I was just trying to get one done. I mean, not even, you know, first things first. Don't even think of getting published. Just think of completing that, you know, number of words, just climbing that mountain. And, I got the first one published, and, you know, I was only thinking of just having, a book with my name on it to hold in my hands, and just, and that was my dream. And that would just, you know, put me on cloud nine. And then it just kept going forward. And I'm like, what? Really? We're still going? And so, and it kind of, just the readership, they've been so kind and so enthusiastic. And here I am, number 20, nice round number.
Listen, you do good book. That's why the fans, you know, are still with you, kiddo. So that's pretty good, right?
Thank you.
Listen, you know, that's my job. But I actually, like you, I read so much, Tim. Oh my God. You don't have, you can just imagine. I laugh. And I think when I read your stuff, do you care more about the laughter or the thinking?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't want to be boring, and I don't want to sound preachy, you know, or shrill. So I want there to be the laughter. And but then I don't want to be shallow. So I guess I want the thoughts in there too, but if I'm just if I start to get serious and I'm just like, it turns into being preachy, then I'll either cut it out or I'll say, find a way to make this amusing. Find, you know, you can do it simultaneously, and and you can find a way to whatever point you're trying to make. There is a way to make it to humorous vein. That's the challenge.
Which comes easier for you? Are you innately more of a passionate person who sees issues and wants to, you know, put out those issues in your way, or are you innately funny first and then? Which do you see? Which comes to your eye first, to your heart first?
Well, if I'm succeeding at what I'm doing, it might be because both are happening at the same time, that I'm maybe that type of person. And I also think, I think it was to a great degree, I was influenced by when I was young, this is what got me started, is I was reading authors that just blew my socks off. And I discovered, curriculum in school was boring. I started reading like Kurt Vonnegut, Joseph Heller, and they were doing the same thing simultaneously. If you look at Vonnegut, the knock on him early on was, oh, it's too easy to read. It's not, complicated enough. It's, in other words, it was so amusing that it can't be literature, because basically literature had to be impenetrable, But yet there was such humanity and such points being made. And so I guess all of the authors that I really loved and inspired me were doing two things, in stereo at once. They were being funny and amusing, as well as, saying what was on their mind. So I guess maybe I was influenced into trying to do both simultaneously.
So does that make you schizophrenic?
I've been called worse. So I'll take that.
Which I note at the beginning of the intro. But all right, so Clownfish Blues. All right, I, you and I are about the same age, I think. And I'm laughing because of, this is like the good road buddy TV mega hit starring the great Martin Milner and George Maharis, replaced by Glenn Corbett, I think, with the blue eyes, if memory serves me correct, in their vintage silver convertible Corvette going down Route 66. Give me a little bit of background on this story of yours, Clownfish Blues.
Yeah, there was Route 66, the famous black and white huge TV show, probably the biggest when it was airing in the early 60s. And I didn't know this. A reader tipped me off several years ago. And then I went out and I bought the DVD collection online and started watching it. But, you think Route 66, the mother road from, Chicago to Los Angeles. And a lot of the early part of the series took place along there. And then as the series progressed, they needed to branch out and have more locales. So Route 66 became less of that road as a geographical line and more of a philosophy of just, they were on the road going from town to town, freedom of wherever they wanted to go. And in the last two seasons, particularly last season, they filmed a ton of episodes in Florida, including the series finale, the two episode finale in Tampa. And pretty much, the last season, especially the last half of the season, was almost all in Florida. And they traveled around both coasts and spent a lot of time down here. And so when I saw that, because, my characters through the books up to now, they're natural road trippers. That's, it's in their DNA. And so when I found out that Route 66, spent so much time in Florida, and it was fascinating watching the episodes, because they were shot on location and they're like these time capsules of, you get to see these parts of Florida as they really were at the time. And so I watched all that, and I have my character. He gets a car like they had, and he's, going from town to town doing his Route 66 adventures, as well as telling the readers all about which episodes, we're here and what happened and where they were located. They went to I think St. Augustine and Daytona Beach. They went to the Mermaids at Weegee-Wachee and obviously Tampa and, down south to the Everglades.
So how did you get onto it? I mean, what How did this turn into this? I mean, you were driving along and you thought Route 66, or you saw some. Well, how did it go from A to Z and become the crux of the book?
Well, once I found out, I looked it up on the internet, and there was various episode guides, and I went down to I saw all these Florida episodes. So, like I said, then I ordered the DVD set and watched it.
No, I get that. I get that. I just was curious as to why you went there, why you decided that this was this was fodder for you to build a whole plot line, new story around. What was it about it?
Well, it naturally fit the personality of the series up to that point because, A, both it had that sense of wanderlust, the freedom that Serge and Coleman, they're always doing this, in previous volumes, and as well as the fact that, apart from being, old classic TV, these were little historical, retrospectives of Florida. And, so it was, basically Florida was showcased, I think in 1963, that season, for the country through this TV show. And so, and that's one of the things I like to do is, I like to use my books to bird dog things I really love about Florida that I found out. It's kind of like elbowing the guy, next year or whatever, hey, check this out. This is really cool. And so that's, that was kind of, and that part of my main character, Serge, is me. That's my alter ego. I mean, I'm nonviolent, unlike him, but his childlike enthusiasm for this sort of stuff. And so it was a natural fit for his personality, and it was a natural fit for, the personality of the books being on the move around, around the state so much.
I get it. It was a natural fit. And I see that. And I hope the state of Florida is giving you lots of money on the promo you're doing for them. Or maybe they're not so crazy about it. Tim, this is interesting to me. I remember Miami when Miami had no houses on the islands. But I say this about Florida, which is always from day one, from when my folks and my grandparents were, early settlers of Florida, if you will, there's a certain seediness. At the same time, there is this extraordinary glamour. The only other place that comes close, I think, is Las Vegas, but Las Vegas doesn't do it the way Florida does. And your plot with this, you're picking up that wonderful Florida lottery. Talk to me. Do you see those elements? Do you get the dichotomy? Or if you go, the further north you go in Florida, the further south you get. So you get into the old days of Florida and you can get into some of that great, raw, beautiful, untouched land, some aspects of it. Talk to me.
Yeah, you mentioned the different elements. It's kind of, you mentioned Vegas. What I think of is Casablanca, in the movie. It kind of has that, chicness, but that shady undercurrent all the time. And that's how I've seen that. I do remember the idyllic old days from the 60s. But even then, there was stuff going on. I mean, I used this in a previous book, but even back in those days, the biggest gem heist in the history of the world up to that point, was up in New York, and it was some Florida surfers went up to the Museum of Natural History and used ropes and climbed in one of the upper windows that was open. And then they came back down to Florida. And of course this, marries the two elements, the glamour and other stuff. And they, of course they got caught because they were nuts and they came back with all these stuff. And then they started having these big parties, and they had this one big pool party where, they were, they had all these girls, and they would throw a diamond in the pool, and all these girls would jump in the pool and try to find the diamond. They would do this over and over again because they had so many diamonds. And if you can imagine that happening back around 1964 in Florida, even back then it was a little over the top.
Yeah, well, I won't tell you that I was there in 64 for that per se. But I do remember my parents used to stay at the Casablanca Hotel. I remember that before the Eden Rock and the Fountain Blue were built. Miami Beach was really quite hilarious. I'll tell you off air stories of mine, in Miami in the late 60s. But now all of that being said, let me ask you this, and let's get serious. What drives plot drive character for you, or character drive plot?
Characters drive the plot, definitely. I mean, I work on the plot. It's kind of left brain, right brain. You know, my characters, I have what they want to do, and I have a lot of kind of ideas that I jot down. Sometimes even while writing the previous book, if something's not going to fit in. But it's characters all the way, and I'll come up with a plot that they can, you know, acclimate to and be in character with, but then that's why I have to work on the plot, because if I don't really work on the plot, the characters will just, you know, run rampant. They'll just, be just totally, tangential throughout the whole book.
And as far as your key character, Serge, do you like him? Do you love him? Do you hate him? Do you D all of the above? How important?
Well, I love him, God, and I'm not even, I won't even go down the facetious route of, you know, he's paying the bills, but there's the part of him that lacks impulse control, and he flies off the handle with, violently. You know about that? Okay, that's the opposite of me, absolute opposite. The rest of him is me on the nose. You know, he's my mouthpiece. All I gotta do is think of my own thoughts. I've just gotta have to, basically take the filters off and let my imagination roam, and that's him. In other words, what he does as far as when he travels and he gets overcome with zeal about, like you mentioned, some, just as you were mentioning Eden Rock and the Fountain Blue, my mind was flashing on, those things. I mean, they're fabulous. And, when I go and explore these places, I explore them like he would. I take a ton of photos, I'm just like almost like a little kid on the balls of his feet, and I'm looking around. And I remember the Fountain Blue, I went down into the, I think there's a, I don't know if it's the basement, but it's the lower level. It's below the lobby level. And there's the old, and I don't know if it was that or if it was the Deauville. It was one of the two, but they had an old barber shop down there. It was still running. They had all the pictures of all the celebrities from the 50s that had come through there. So I'm taking pictures of the pictures, and it was, the place was empty. I mean, there was nobody, around that whole section of shops down there. And it really was, like walking through the 50s. So that part of him is definitely me. I think I took that part of me and put it onto the character, frankly, when I was starting out the series.
So you like the past better than the present?
No, I like the present, but I like to see stuff that is worthwhile, that hasn't been torn down or taken away from us, if you know what I'm saying. In other words, where you get to see, how things were. I like the past in the present tense. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I do think that that's something that is unique to Florida, by the way, because for all the trashing they've allowed in the state, and so much has been wrecked, which is sad, there's still, if you do go down to Miami, you can still walk and feel the 50s and the 60s and the 40s even in the landscape, which is hard to believe considering all that's been built up down there. And I think throughout the rest of the state too, I don't know, maybe because I'm, spend so much time in South Florida, we tend to think that's only the place. And I tend to think of that only as Florida, that the rest of it's just kind of someplace else, if you will, but not so. You can find that, that landscape, the further north you go, it's even better in a way. I think you take off, by the way, you take 3 weeks a year. I guess when you're hawking your books, but also on your own to go back to your favorite place and look at it.
What I do is I really, because of, how the books do well in Florida, and there's so many markets, and Florida's kind of different from other states where if you just circle the perimeter of the state, all the different markets are lined up for you. And, the only real stretch is going across the Everglades is, I'll hit Miami and then come across to Naples and go up. I circle the state, I pack it with all these, events. And then, in between events, if I have any, free time here and there, I have a list of places that, either I want to revisit or I want to see if I can find, You know, and like, for example, I was going through Jacksonville, just to give one, for instance, and I heard that there was one remaining car from the Orange Blossom Special that was somewhere out there, and somebody sent me a photograph. It was all stuck back in the woods with weeds all over it or whatever, and now it's kind of on display, but there's nothing saying what it is. It's just there on the, you know, next to the convention center. And so I took a side trip and, you know, went under an underpass and parked there and went over and took some pictures of it. But that's the sort of thing that I love to find. You know, after knowing the whole history of that song and, you know, Irvin Rouse being on the platform back there and, you know, writing that fiddle song, and then Johnny Cash covered it, and going back and finding one of the only train car, and possibly is the only one from the original Orange Blossom Special that's still, you know, you can find anywhere. And so, but those are the sort of things. I have a little scavenger list that I like to tuck in when I do that 3 weeks.
I was going to ask you your favorite place, but I don't want to do that because I don't want you to tell everybody so that they go there and they ruin it.
I can tell you, and because they won't be able to. It's the Dry Tortugas, and it's hard to get to. So
you don't think anybody's going to go in and spoil that great and gorgeous landscape. Listen to me. You write great title. I'm hoping it's you who writes these titles. Do you write the titles or do you work with your editors to get the titles?
No, they're my titles.
They're your titles. Let me just throw out a few. Coconut Cowboy. Sharkskin Suite. S-U-I-T-E. Tiger Shrimp Tango. I want to eat your titles, by the way. Pineapple Grenade. And of course, Clownfish Blues. What comes first? Does the title come first, or does the plot come first, or what? Love these titles.
It goes both ways. Sometimes I think of the book and I know what I'm going to write, and you know simply what the book is going to be about just dictates a title to me. And other times I can't come up with a title, and this one worked out. I actually had this title a long time ago with no book, and then I wrote this book, and I was working with other titles. When I thought of that old title, and it applied to, it kind of applies to what happens to one of the other characters in the books, which is this reporter who becomes increasingly frustrated with the decline of traditional journalism. And so that's his growing funk about all that is the blues part of it, and as it relates to him. But so in that case, that's how it fit together.
You know, I don't know why I want to ask you this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. It struck me as Trump fits into this, our new president, somehow in all of this. This book. I don't know why. Maybe it's the crazy. You know, maybe Serge is crazy. Reminds me of Trump crazy a little. No, and I don't want to get into your politics. It may not be the same as mine, but you know, it's very, if you think about reportage and you know, problem, because you're a former journalist, like the journalism's going through right now, you know, it is pretty interesting. Yes.
Are you talking about like fake news and stuff?
Oh, that stuff. You remember that, right? We know about that, right?
Yeah, but I mean, is that what you're referring to?
There's a lot of crazy right now, okay? I mean, you turn on TV, it's like crazy. Everybody I know, all we watch is basically, is a lot of politics, fake news, crazy, uncontrolled politicians, things coming out of their mouth, you know, wacky scenes like we watched the other day with that press, you know, press conference. If that wasn't really a press conference, with Sean Spicer. I mean, you know, a president who seems to control his mechanisms, kind of like your friend in your books. I was just feeling a lot of it. Fake news. I don't know what's fake news. I mean, fake news, you know, that's been bandied around.
Someone else mentioned the same thing about this book, and they said, did you like, you know, right. And basically, I wrote this before the presidential campaign even started, you know, before he came down the escalator. And I wrote it about the state of journalism and about what people believe out there. And they said, were you influenced or did you see the future? And I'm like, no, I just kind of, you know, if you're a journalist and you just kind of see how things, you know, are devolving. It was just a natural progression for me to go there. But, yeah.
You've got zeitgeist. I mean, you know, that's if you can keep your pulse and you're ahead of the pulse when the general public picks up it on the zeitgeist of where we are, that's what makes a great journalist, I always think. And I think you did that in this book. And I think it's worth reading, if for no other reason, to get a little insight into all of that, not being funny at all, just being really straightforward. You're an entrepreneur. So... on your website. I mean, just, yeah, I know the story about your t-shirts, that you were one of the first, you know, people. You went to the BEA and brought t-shirts and made a lot of money and got people going, oh yeah, we can hawk our wares with t-shirts or whatever. You've got a lot for sale on your website, which we'll give at the end of the show. But I'm thinking you should open a restaurant, and each thing that you order should be Clownfish Blues or any of the other titles. I mean, wow. I get hungry when I just read your titles.
Well, if there's any entrepreneurs out there in the restaurant business who want to do something like that,
well, that
email.
The building on your website, where you is that real, or is that does that really have a place where you can buy your stuff, or is that just you just put the building up there because it's old Florida?
Yeah, I took a picture of an old citrus souvenir place that was boarded up, and it just looked funky to me, and so I had that. So when I had to put a picture of what my store would look like, I mean, it's an online store. There's no physical,
right,
brick and mortar.
But I was going crazy from that, and thinking, I'd like to let Tim, you and I, let's go into business and let's open that up and put it on, a highway, and, a restaurant in it. I was going crazy. Anyway, I'm just going wacko on you because I just finished reading your wonderful Clownfish Blues and I'm feeling a little wacky. You inspire. So I'm going to ask you a completely off the crazy cuff as we shut down on this conversation that I don't know if it's made even an ounce of sense. Choose writing or sex. Which do you prefer?
I'm sorry, what was that?
I have to deliver it twice. Choose writing or sex. Which do you put first? Oh, God.
I'll take the fifth.
You want me to hold you to that?
Both at the same time.
So I didn't hear. No, I didn't hear you. What'd you say?
Actually, I've done both at the same time.
Oh, you have not?
Oh, you don't believe me?
No, I do not believe you. Oh, my God. No, Are you telling the truth? Are you kidding me?
I'm going to leave it there.
I've been speaking with best-selling author, master of mayhem, Tim Dorsey, introducing his latest wacky thriller, Clownfish Blues, on the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. For more about Tim Dorsey and for information on his appearances, as well as more about Tim and his work, visit his website at timdorsey.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, a production of Resec LLC. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit HallieKasserJane.com. We'll be right back.